Here is a poem about love, well, love of a sort. Here it is. The act of love lies somewhere between the belly and the mind. I lost the love some time ago, now I've only the act to grind. Brought her back from a party, don't bother swapping names. Identity's not needed when you're only playing games. High on bedroom darkness, we endure the pantomime. Ships that go bump in the night, run aground on the sands of time. Saved in the nick of dawn, it's cornflakes and then goodbye. Another notch on the headboard, another day wondering why. The act of love lies somewhere between the belly and the mind. I lost the love some time ago. Now I've only the act to grind. Few cultures have bandied the word love around more freely than ours. Yet as those words from Roger McDuff's poem indicate, an enormous number of people do experience a great difficulty in finding the quality of interpersonal relationship they really seek in love. The man in the poem, for instance, tells us that he had found love elusive and had been forced to substitute empty sex in its place. And there are many in society today who make the same unsatisfactory exchange. Now, what has happened? Why is this? How come we're the most sexually active generation ever and yet the most lonely? What's happened? Eric Fromm, in his book, The Act of Loving, blames it all on the economic system, which he says has rendered real love impossible by its cultivation of self-interest. Men and women do not really love one another anymore. They use one another for their fulfillment of their individual needs. It's a kind of commercial contract, he says. So just as a car owner uses a mechanic to service his car, so men and women use each other. Other sociologists have drawn attention to the role of eroticism in the culture and the way that that has prevented real men from loving real women. There's a striking passage in the feminist writer Naomi Wolf's book, The Beauty Myth, in which a woman gets up in the morning and she looks at herself in the mirror and she says, at that moment, I hated my boyfriend because I knew I had so much work to do before he arrived to take me out casually for brunch. So much work to do before I knew that he would love me. And you know this poem by Steve Turner. Tonight we will fake love together. You, my love, possess all the essential qualities as listed by Playboy. You'll last me as long as 2 weeks or until such a time as your face and figure go out of fashion. I will hold you close to my Hollywood standard body, the smell of which has been approved by my 10 best friends and a representative of Lifebuoy. I will prop my paperback Kama Sutra on the dressing table and like program seals, we will perform. And like human beings, we'll grow tired of our artificially sweetened, diluted, ready-to-drink love affairs. Tonight, we will fake love. The sarcasm is heavy, but it's hardly unjustified, is it? Turner speaks for a great many people today whose dreams of loving relationships lie shattered, invariably ending up as empty and unsatisfying shams, faking love rather than making it. So what is the problem? What torpedoes love in our culture? Is it capitalism? Is it eroticism? Well, I want to tell you what has most struck me in all this. It's a study published 20 years ago entitled The Habits of the Heart. In it, a small group of sociologists at Berkeley University in California analyzed people's attitudes to social commitments and the tension between individual freedom and social commitment. And one of the most important findings concerned people's attitudes towards feelings. The sociologists who compiled the book discovered that with older people, more traditional ideas took the view that feelings should always come second place to duty. Hence, a higher value was placed by such people on virtues like self-control, self-denial, self-discipline, self-sacrifice. Marital love was seen in this view as fundamentally a commitment of the will, which one ought to honor irrespective of whether one's feelings about it were always good or bad. So in the marriage service, you see, in terms of this old idea, the groom is asked, and I've stood down there and taken many marriages, will you take this woman to be your wife? Will you love her, comfort her, honor and protect her, forsaking all others, be faithful to her as long as you both shall live? And he responds, I will. But the researchers discovered back in the 1980s that that traditional attitude was very rapidly being displaced in modern society by a different attitude, which they characterized as the therapeutic attitude. In this, feelings take priority over everything else. And the important virtues are not those which restrain the expression of self, but those which liberate it. Honesty, openness. These are what count, not self-denial, self-control, or self-discipline, but rather self-fulfillment, self-realization, self-acceptance, self-actualization, self-esteem. These are the buzzwords of the therapeutic attitude. The spontaneous sharing of feelings between authentic, expressing human beings. This is the therapeutic ideal of love. And long-term commitment does not necessarily feature in such relationships at all. According to the therapeutic attitude, if my emotional needs are not being met by my partner, I'm entitled to sever the relationship. So the therapeutic attitude denies all forms of social obligation or duty, replacing them with the ideals of open, honest communication instead. The only thing a therapeutically liberated lover owes to his or her partner is to share his or her feelings fully. Emotional independence and contentment is the goal. So I must be happy in this short life. I must be happy. And a personal relationship is simply a device for achieving my happiness. So if it's not working for me, then it and the person has to go. You see, life is about choices, not commitments. And if a commitment isn't making me happy, I must make a different choice. And you may have to be disposed of in the process. Now don't get me wrong here, the therapeutic attitude is not all bad. It has been a great help to making people more self-aware, in helping them get in touch with their feelings, and in seeing, let's say, the guilt-inducing manipulations of the family, the culture, or the workplace. And I tell you, I wish that some of my contemporaries in the ministry that I went to theological college with were more self-aware and had done some investigation into some of the core ideas here. They're helpful for self-awareness. But the problem is, carried to an extreme, this kind of therapeutic attitude is desperately corrosive of loving relationships. So no doubt capitalism, by its endorsement of self-interest, has prepared the ground for such a new attitude. And no doubt the media, with its preoccupation with erotic images, has encouraged and exploited it. But I tell you, the root of our culture's decay in loving interpersonal relationships between the sexes is not economic or erotic. It is moral. We must see that actually we've changed the goalposts about love in the last 50 years. What we've done as a culture, do you realize this, is we have redefined the meaning of the word love. So it is no longer a sacrificial commitment to another person. That is what it was. It is now the intensity of feeling within myself. That's what love is. What I feel. And I have stood just there as I've taken weddings, and on some of the weddings, thankfully many this hasn't been the case, but on some, I found myself asking with the couple in front of me, what is going on here for you? Are you really committing yourself sacrificially to this person? Or is this all about the intensity of feelings you're feeling for yourself today? What's going on? It's no longer a sacrificial commitment to another person. It's now the intensity of feelings within myself. And that change has come very subtly, but it's now almost universal in our thinking, and it's in your thinking. It is. The act of love lies somewhere between the belly and the mind. My belly and my mind. Little wonder that love feels uncontrollably volatile and elusive. Because it's somewhere here and it keeps disappearing on me. I mean, where's it gone now? I don't seem to be feeling it today between my belly and my mind. How do I get it back? I lost it some time ago, says our poet. Now I'm left only with the act to grind. And this is what makes Ruth and the book that bears her name such a candle in the darkness for us. Because it's all about the difference which interpersonal commitment can make to our experience of love. And let's remember that the context of this book was the time of the judges. And that too significantly was a period when the old moral order was disintegrating. Oh yeah, the marriage book thrown on one side. There was anarchy. Let's have a look at it. Judges 21 verse 25. Can you see as you look down the last verse of the book? It says it all. Ring any bells? In those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit, and doubtless they were led by their feelings. This was a society in which the law of the jungle prevailed. It was utterly individualistic and hedonistic. And even then, Ruth would have been seen as a very old-fashioned book and a very old-fashioned girl. For this story is meant to convince us that love is a commitment, a sacrificial commitment to somebody else or to a group of other people, a laying down, a crucified life. It's about loyalty and duty and the cost which comes from putting the needs of others above our own. It's about the way God achieves his purpose in history through insignificant little people who trust him enough to take the risks which sacrificial, committed covenant, Calvary, love demands. And there are two headings, and they both reflect the theme of covenant love. There's the bride and the bridegroom. By the way, this book begins with three funerals. It ends with a wedding. Do you think that would be a good title for it? Three funerals and a wedding. Anyway, there you go. But let's have a look now. The opening heading is the bride. The bride. And let's look at chapter 4, verse 13, to see the bride. We've got the bride and the bridegroom. Let's have a look at the bride. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And can you see who is the focus of this paragraph? Do you know, interestingly, it's not Ruth. Though she has got married and had a child, the emotional focus in the words of the women who come on like a Greek chorus is Naomi. Do you see, the women said to Naomi, verse 14, "Praise to the Lord who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He'll renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given birth." And then one of the most touching verses in the Bible. "Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap." Victor Hugo wrote that life's greatest happiness is to be convinced you are loved. And that is certainly Naomi's experience of her daughter-in-law. So in chapter 1, contrary to all good sense and her own best interests, Ruth commits herself in love to her widowed mother-in-law Naomi. Rather than leave this old woman bereft, Ruth abandons her own country of Moab and accompanies Naomi to Judah, chapter 1, verse 16. "Where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God." And you know, it's amazing. Ruth, this new believer, deliberately echoes the covenant vow of Jehovah to Israel in her own covenant vow to Naomi. She picks it up. She lives it out to her mother-in-law. She's in a covenant relationship, and that is what real love is about. Now, if Ruth had only been interested in self-fulfillment, she'd have ditched Naomi and gone in search of a husband among her own people. "I've got to get a life. I can't hang around this mother-in-law." But no, she was part of Naomi's family, and one of the few members of that family left alive. And she was determined to put that God, that loyalty, first, whatever the sacrifice. Now, strikingly, Orpah, Naomi's other daughter-in-law, chapter 1, verse 14, can't face such a cost and returns to Moab. And doubtless, as she left her mother-in-law and her sister-in-law, she could have found a good counselor in Moab who said to her, "Now, Orpah, this is awful for you. What you most need to be is really open about your feelings and honest at the grief of the separation. That's what you've got to deal with and work through." But Ruth, a Moabitess, heads to Judah, a foreign woman, and now one of two destitute widows with the national reputation of being almost a prostitute. That is how dangerous Moabite women were seen to be in Israel's history. And then last week, we saw the most extraordinary example of Ruth's commitment to covenant love. Chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. Can we just click on and see it? Chapter 3, 8 and 9. "In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet." So here is Boaz being woken by Ruth on the threshing floor. Actually, some commentators compare this to Adam being woken by God and seeing Eve. So he wakes, verse 9, and he says, "Who are you?" "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." Now, we learnt last week that what Ruth says to Boaz here is, "Marry me. Marry me." She says, just as you prayed in chapter 2, verse 12, "May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you've come to take refuge. So now let me come under the protection of God's wings by coming under the protection of your garment, Boaz." So she's saying, Boaz, be the answer to your own prayers of chapter 2, verse 12. And this is the key. This is what's so striking. as she uses the word garment, a covenant word for God in Ezekiel 16, and as she calls Boaz to be her kinsman redeemer, a word linked to the care of the destitute family member in Leviticus 25, it's as though she has Naomi, her mother-in-law, standing right next to her on the threshing floor. As she says, kinsman redeemer, she's saying, I've got my arm round my mother-in-law, Boaz. She's saying, Boaz, please marry me, but I come with my mother-in-law and I will not break my vows of love to her. So she says, I'll be your bride, but please help me keep my covenantal commitment to this woman. And that is why Boaz responds, verse 10, the Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. The kindness he's referring to is Ruth's kindness to Naomi. He's staggered by her covenantal godliness. Here is this man, an Israelite, brought up in the faith, and this Moabite woman comes in, a new believer, and he is staggered by her example and her godliness. And you know, she uses some chat-up line for him that night. You know, she says to him, Boaz, Ezekiel 16, Leviticus 25, here I am with my mother-in-law. Some chat-up line. That's what she says. Verse 10, you've not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. He says, you know, he says, you're remarkable. Not only did you come here, chapter 2, verse 11, with your mother-in-law, but her well-being is your first comment as you put yourself in front of me. Oh, she's looking lovely in front of him, but as she puts herself in front of him, she says, these are my commitments. These are my duties. This is Naomi. And he says, you know, amazes her, he says, you know, you haven't gone round to a singles bar where you probably could have got a husband. No, you've come to me, an older man, with your mother-in-law, and you've said, I'm totally committed to covenant love. Here's my mother-in-law. Will you help me live this out as I become your bride? Now, how does this apply to us? It's staggering stuff. Well, Kenneth Clark, in his book Civilization, comments that we can destroy ourselves by cynicism as well as by bombs. And that is a shrewd observation, because it's all too easy when evil is in the transcendent to become demoralized and pessimistic. Many an idealistic young person surrenders to disillusionment under the pressure of a world in which goodness so often seems to lose out. Are you like that? It's the cynicism growing. And in some respects, that is the danger for Naomi in this story. She's a woman of faith. In fact, she probably led Ruth to faith. But she's reduced by the devastating impact of family bereavement to a state of stubborn resentment towards God. Chapter 1, verse 20. Let's have a look at it. Let's see what state Naomi's in. Verse 20. Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara. Because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. Now, some here may very much be able to relate to Naomi's words. She articulates the honest complaint of many a believer who find themselves the innocent victim of God's judgment in a fallen world, and it can be a very brutal fallen world. And she sort of says, how can you go on believing in God when things like this happen? She says, I have buried both my sons and my husband, and I have no pension. That's what she cries out. The world that I'm left in is too miserable, too pain-riddled, too tragic for faith in any God to survive except a God of ruthless and callous indifference. That's the only God I can believe in, some Greek God who's ruthless and callous. Look at my son's coffins. But Naomi discovers that her cynicism is misplaced. And she ends this story with her grandson in her lap, chapter 4, 16 and 17. Let's have a look at it again. Let's flick on. That's how it ends. Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap and cared for him. She has spoken too soon. And, you know, it's interesting. My experience as I've watched love in families, I don't think it gets any more unconditional than grandparents and grandchildren. What a joy. She's got little Obed to care for and love and nurture. And when she's tired, she can give it back to Ruth. It's marvelous. Verse 17, the women living there said, Naomi has a son and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse. And can you believe this? From a Moabite womb, the grandfather of David. So Naomi, as she's howling, oh, you know, call me Mara. In God's plan, as you step back, she's going to be part of salvation history. She's going to be the great-great-grandmother of David. Her name remembered forever. At the end of the day, God's love will be victorious. He's sovereign. He's in control. He's the ultimate redeemer. But here is the issue. How was Naomi's faith restored to her? It was a result of her personally experiencing the human love and sacrifice and service of Ruth. That is how her faith in the covenant love of Israel was restored, because another human being demonstrated such love to her. On the threshing floor, she said, Boaz, here I am, but only if my mother-in-law comes with me under the roof. So let me ask you, if you're a Christian here this morning, and you believe in the covenant love of God, which actually ultimately went to the cross, that is the extent of his love for me, that he says, Rico, I love you so much that I pay in death and blood to have you forgiven as my enemy as you come into relationship with me. My enemy, I pay for you to be forgiven. I fill you with my spirit. I greet you as a son. I bring you into covenant. If you believe in that cross-shaped love, then my question is, who is your Naomi? Here is Ruth, a young Christian, a Moabitess, a widow in a strange land, yet staggering Boaz by her kindness, by her sacrificial covenant love. And my question is, what about you? Is there anyone you're loving like this? Anyone? She's a baby believer. She's just lost her husband. She's got every reason to go with Orpah back to Moab, but she doesn't. Who has God called you to love like this? Or what task has he called you to do that is going to actually require you, frankly, to crucify yourself? Why do it? Because Christ was crucified for you. That's covenant love. You're just imitating his love. And loving this person particularly, may I say, it may well be all about self-sacrifice, self-discipline, self-denial. And as I say that, can I say there are some here who are doing this, and I salute you, and you're a great example to us. Or are you like, here's the issue, the Levite and the priest who turn away from covenant love as they see the wounded traveler on the road to Jericho? Oh no, I haven't got time. I've got my own agendas, you know. But of course, Naomi would not have had that roof over her head and the baby in her lap if Boaz didn't also believe in covenant love. And please see here, point number two, the bridegroom takes on covenant love as well. He's a catalyst for it too. It's not just Ruth that believes in it and models it. So does Boaz. And he is depicted here in this book as a servant-hearted, godly, self-sacrificing believer. You know, as a staff team, if there is someone getting married in the church family here, the question we ask of the man is he going to serve her? Is he going to lay his life down for her as Christ does for the church? And I think as you looked at Boaz, we'd have all said, this is a self-sacrificing man. Let's have a look at him. Chapter 2, verse 8, he tells Ruth to glean in his fields. He says, glean here. Chapter 2, verse 9, he tells the men not to touch her. Chapter 2, verse 12, he prays for her and acknowledges her godliness. Chapter 2, verse 17, the doggy bag Ruth takes home to Naomi weighs 30 pounds, 12 kilos. Fancy walking out of a restaurant with that. Chapter 2, verse 20, Naomi tells us this man is famed for his kindness. He'd be a great husband because he's kind and he's self-sacrificing. Everybody knows that from the way he lives. Chapter 3, verse 10, he is staggered by Ruth's kindness and godliness and realizes that a woman who understands love in that sacrificial, committed way will make an outstanding wife. Forget about her past as a Moabitess. I mean, Boaz is colorblind, as is God. He just sees her as a phenomenal believer. And now in chapter 4, Boaz is contrasted with another relative. So just as Ruth has been contrasted with her sister-in-law in chapter 1, so whilst Orpah walks away from self-sacrificing covenant love in chapter 1, this unnamed relative wants the land Naomi's husband Elimelech left when he went to Moab. That'll be a great buy. Give me the land. And no one else can purchase it. He's first in line to redeem it. Great. But then he shies away from covenant love, from self-sacrificing love, when he realizes he'll have to support Ruth and Naomi, and maybe have kids by this woman. Oh no. Well, let's see it in the first six verses of chapter 4. Can we see? He's brutally revealed in his selfishness and self-interest, this man. Let's have a look. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. When the kinsman redeemer he'd mentioned came along, Boaz said, come over here, my friend, and sit down. So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here, and they did so. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you'll redeem it, do so. But if you're not, tell me so that I will know, for no one has the right to do it except you, and I'm next in line. I'll redeem it, he says. Great offer. Wonderful. Verse 5, now he gets revealed. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. At this, the kinsman redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. Can you see? Oh, what about me? What about me, he says. I mean, forget about God's law. Forget about my duty to these relatives who've fallen on hard times. Forget about the responsibility to care for Elimelech's family. He wants his land, but not his widows. And he does not want the law of God, this man. You see, it's all there. I might endanger my own estate. And as I ask you who your Naomi is, can I say some of you are thinking, no, I might endanger my own estate. I'm not going to love people like that. No, I might endanger my own estate. There he is, you see. And there's Naomi. There's his duty standing in front of him, the good work he is to do, and he walks away. Now, Boaz will do no such thing. And what is amazing about Boaz, as he does the right thing and redeems the land and takes on not just Ruth, but Naomi and the family line, as he does that, can you see what God is doing in his life? Have a look, verses 21, 22. Salmon, the father of Boaz, Boaz, the father of Obed, Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of David. In the big picture, which Boaz can't see, which Ruth can't see, which Naomi can't see, they're just being godly. In the big picture, they're part of salvation history. The question is, will they trust God and obey and leave the consequences through history, King David, to God in his sovereignty? Ian O'Brien is a very fine Bible teacher. He's in Australia, and he's written commentaries. I have a couple of them, a very fine commentary on Colossians, another one on Philippians. He's a Christian, humanly speaking, because his mother's next-door neighbour for 14 years died of MS. And she did so with such self-sacrifice and godliness that his mother came to faith, and Ian came to faith, and now pastors all over the world have commentaries. If you'd said to that woman, you die well, and men all over the world will have commentaries, she'd have said, deal. But she couldn't see the big picture. She just had to die well in front of her next door neighbour. And I have commentaries because of her. The big picture was that God was going to produce David, and ultimately Christ, through this line. But Boaz couldn't see it, and nor could Ruth, and nor can you. We just see in front of us the Naomi. So can I ask again, who is your Naomi? Where is the Lord calling you to covenant love, to sacrificial love, to redemptive love, to Calvary love? Where is he calling you to crucify himself, to crucify yourself for someone else? You see, this story, brothers and sisters, is designed to deprogram us from our selfish, individualistic, therapeutic attitude towards love. A love that's just about the intensity of the feelings between the belly and the mind, rather than about sacrificial commitment to someone else. And it was needed in the time of Judges, just as needed today. It's a story that is meant to encourage us to believe that if we really want to know what love means in its fullest and richest form, then we must be willing for commitment and sacrifice as the price of love. So I ask you again, in the shadow of the cross, who is your Naomi? What is the task that you have to do? And it may well mean crucifying yourself. But who is your Naomi? Let's pray together. Who is your Naomi? What is God calling you to do? Father God, we ask your forgiveness for the times when we have displayed self-love, when we've bought into the God of our own happiness and not the good of others. And give us the strength, we pray, in our lives, model covenantal love, the love of Ruth, the love of Boaz. And Father, as we do that, please help us to trust in your sovereignty, to leave the results to you. But Lord, please help us to be obedient, to be self-sacrificing, and to stand against the culture. Amen.